Welcome to Series 3 of The Great Humbling. What does it mean to be humbled? Perhaps it's to be less proud, to feel less important, even a little defeated. From the Latin humus, ground, to be grounded, and humilis, brought to the ground, made low or lowly. My name's Ed Gillespie, and I'm a poet, futurist, and recovering sustainability consultant. In the early days of the pandemic, I started recording these conversations with the author Dugald Hine, where we wonder together about the strangeness of the times we're in, the altered states into which they push us, and now, in this third series, the new moves that might be called for, if these really are times of being brought back down to earth. So, episode 6. Are we bringing our eyes back into focus again slowly after last week's seeing double? What's been coming into focus for you, Dougald?
Well, it's actually only been 3 days since we recorded the last episode, so my eyes may still be adjusting, but I did have a couple of afterthoughts as things come into focus. The first comes from a long essay by David Cayley, Gaia and the Path of the Earth, where he's weaving connections between our old friend Ivan Illich, who we'll be talking about some more today, and the French philosopher Bruno Latour. And there's a passage in Latour's book, Facing Gaia, where he makes this series of paradoxical statements that kind of culminate in this line, "This contradiction must not be overcome." And Cayley says this is the most important line in the book, that we need these contradictions that we don't try to overcome, these incommensurable opposites, heaven and earth, time and eternity, but that, like the single vision of Blake's Newton, Western philosophy has insisted that contradictions must be eliminated, must be resolved, they can't be allowed to stand. And so Cayley finds something scandalous, in a good way, in Latour's refusal of this, in this insistence that the contradiction must be endured and sustained, not resolved or overcome.
That really struck me when you first mentioned it before we recorded last week's episode, as it chimes so strongly with that sitting with the discomfort and the uncertainty and unknowing that we find it so very, very hard to do. We're always leaping to resolution or solution.
And there's a similar thought that came to me this week from another friend of this podcast, Vanessa Andreotti. And it's something that she says about layering, about the need to develop a layered approach to reality, whereas the conditioning of modernity is to try to make it all fit together, to try to produce a single coherent account. So holding an awareness of, as she says, the layering of intellectual, affective, and relational realms of individual experience, and also the layering of social experience according to both context and affinity. And she writes that this may help us build capacity to hold spaces for paradoxes and contradictions between and within realms, not least for recognizing that the same thing, the same statement, the same idea, the same action might be helpful in one realm and damaging in another. So I guess that kind of making space is what I hope we're doing in the slow unfolding of these conversations. And saying that, I realise I've plunged us pretty fast into the deep end this week. I mean, how about you, Ed? What's been going on since we did Seeing Double?
When you're talking about the layering there, I just keep thinking of that song, "The World is Just a Great Big Onion." We need to peel back the layers. Well, I'm going to take us from your instant depths to muddy shallows. I took my first paddle upstream from the mill, rowing Little Grebe, which is the small wooden boat gifted by the previous owners along with the house. And spring has not yet fully sprung, so the dark branches of the overhanging trees were still festooned with tiny little vivid green leaf buds, and the water's only a foot or so deep over the soft silted clay riverbed. And there was a very slight air of deliverance about the backwoods solitude and murk, but it was so magical. And there was a huge fallen oak tree right across the river, enmeshed in ivy tendrils, and its broken roots still clinging into the bank, forming a thick natural bridge, under which I glided with not a little trepidation. And it's a sort of image you see in fairy tales, under which a troll lurks. And then on my return, a heron swooped in and landed on the bank right next to me, just as I got back to the mill, like a herald. And more than any of the mundane unpacking I've been immersed in, I really felt like I'd arrived.
You know, I've been meaning to tell you, when I was editing the last episode, I noticed there's this background noise on the audio from your end. And suddenly I realised I was hearing the sound of the water running under the floor of the mill. It's a bit different to the sound of the buses on Brixton Hill that we used to have.
Yeah, or the sirens.
But when I saw those pictures of you out in the boat, I was like, firstly, when will they let me get back to England so I can come and join you on that beautiful, gentle waterscape? And then my next thought was, maybe we have to do a special edition of the podcast when I get there. That's a sort of homage to Jerome K. Jerome. We can call it Two Men in a Boat.
We'd have to echo that genius opening line of Three Men in a Boat, which is, there were four of us. or in our case, three. And it's funny, listener David Bent asked on Facebook if you and I were the owl and the pussycat in a beautiful pea green boat. And Little Grebe is actually blue, but hey, you know, a bit of poetic license there. And who would be which? To which I responded, it was obvious you're the wise old owl of this collaboration and I'm the feckless feline.
To wit, to woo. The question is, which of us is bringing the banjo?
Yeah, and who's going to extract the ring out of the pig's nose? But anyway, that's marriage, Dougald. I think that's a bit early for that. Now, after last week's confessional revelation that you've become an accidental futurist, Dougald, would you like to predict the theme of this week's episode?
Well, let's see. What new moves have we had so far? We've had keep it foolish, move your ass, be like water, do shrooms, see double. No, my crystal ball is drawing a blank. Tell me what our newest instruction is, Ed.
Well, drum roll, please. This week's instruction is small yourself up. So I have to share the source of the inspiration for this new move. I worked in Jamaica as a volunteer teacher many, many moons ago. And my main mode of transport when not walking was the bus. And Jamaican buses are quite leery. And they certainly were 30 years ago. Independently run, timetable free, vaguely roadworthy. The bush buses on our route in the parish of St. Catherine were a particular law unto themselves. They were often massively overcrowded, so the conductors were forever attempting to jam more people on board and hence collect more fares from extra passengers. And buses on our wild and winding pothole-riddled mountain road that wove its way from above rocks, which was the village where I worked, down to Kingston, would often literally race each other around the precipitous hairpin bends as the first bus to arrive and load up the queue of patiently waiting business would obviously reap the reward. And would often wait hours for a bus to town. And then, of course, three would turn up at once. The first bus would cash in. The second might get the last few passengers who couldn't physically be crammed into the first or who personally objected to that particular bus driver's road skills. And there were certain drivers some passengers just would not ride with. And the last bus might even have to return to Kingston empty or decide to wait till enough passengers are accumulated again, which might take another few hours. So creating a literally idling asset. And the exhortations of the persuasive conductors to maximise the utility of space on board were always colourful. I mean, they sort of had to be if you wanted to get people to sit on each other's laps or hang over one another in a quite claustrophobic and steamy, sweaty environment while simultaneously balancing goods for market or small children. And my favourite of these requests was always, small yourself up on the bus now. And there's just something wonderfully literal about it, speaking incredibly directly and figuratively. I have to be a bit careful here, I'll end up in Sued's corner in private eye. And I just wanted to contrast that sort of hot Jamaican bus with perhaps the time I felt smallest, which was when I was in Antarctica, when I felt not just small, but insignificant. I mean, minuscule. Perhaps that happens when you take all of your egotism away and you actually feel your real size, because a basically vulnerable, hairless ape doesn't seem so big and clever in a blizzard. And Antarctica is so immense, both in terms of its expansive geography and riotously rugged topography. You can't help but feel diminutive there. And I barely brushed the tip of the proverbial iceberg, that little slender finger of the peninsula that reaches out to tickle Tierra del Fuego. And, you know, you realise the mountains of the Transantarctic Massive are massive, but they're almost entirely buried underneath this all-consuming cloak of ice, which is several kilometres thick. And you whisk it away, and Antarctica is not a single landmass, but a vast continental archipelago of mountains and basins. So I felt infinitesimally tiny. But Dougald, have you ever felt the need to small yourself up?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think anyone of our generation, any man who grew up with the kind of privileges of being white and some kind of middle class and having the kind of cultural and social advantages which come with growing up in a house full of books and going to a good university, if you've any shred of self-awareness, then you're going to have hit some humbling moments where it's brought home to you how much space you're taking up, how naturally it comes to you to take up space, whether that's man-spreading on the tube or being quick to jump in and say whatever comes to your mind in a meeting. I remember in my 20s when we were doing School of Everything, one of my co-founders, Paul Miller, had been a senior researcher at the think tank Demos. And he told me how they had this concept of airtime there, because they had a lot of bright young people coming straight out of university, and often they arrive with a lot to say for themselves. And so as an organizational culture, they needed an explicit way of talking about the need to check how much space you were taking up in a meeting and whether that was disproportionate. And so that's where their concept of airtime came from.
I'm getting an ever so slight Lord of the Flies flashback here with the symbolic role of the conch in meetings. You know, you can only speak when you're in possession of the conch, which in theory gives everyone an equal chance to speak. But apologies, Dougald, I believe you had the conch.
There's something there more generally about education and class that can sometimes go missing from the factors that get emphasised these days when we talk about privilege. I mean, I remember in that same phase of my life, meeting a guy who'd just become chief executive of an organization that was all about training and opportunities for young people who haven't gone to university. And he described how in his first week in that job, he'd had two meetings, one with a graduate employer who said to him, first thing we have to do with these young people who are coming to work for us straight out of university is get them to see that just because they have a good degree, it doesn't mean they know everything. And the other was a hairdresser who was talking about the trainees they had, school leavers coming to them at 16. And she said, the first thing I have to do with these young people is convince them that they're not useless. Because so much about our education system and our society is set up to tell you that if you succeed in the educational game, you rock. And if you fail in it, you suck. And it really struck me listening to him how damaging both sides of that are, and how I've seen that, you know, in myself, in what my education did to me, but also in other people who I grew up with who didn't end up on anything like the path that I got to go on. So yeah, I mean, for me, part of being humbled is definitely learning to small myself up, to sit in a group and maybe hardly say anything through the course of an hour or two, but be listening hard and holding space and letting go of the need I would once have felt to make myself heard.
Yeah, I remember at the rather infamous Findhorn New Story Summit a few years ago, where in a gathering of 400 to 500 vocal global activists, there was obviously an enormous struggle to, A, firstly, keep plenary contributions concise, and secondly, to ensure a diversity of voices, which is no easy task when almost everyone in the room feels they have something vital and important to say, their own unique experience and special insight. And the truth is, you know, they probably did. You know, you looked around the room and you thought, I just want to hear from all of these people. And at one point, Naresh Giagrand of the Transition Movement stood up and just very quietly suggested to the somewhat overeager crowd that they might self-police their own contributions by asking themselves whether they would add more to the gathering than a moment of powerful collective shared silence. And that was humbling.
Yeah, I can imagine. A few years ago, I hosted a series of conversations at Newspeak House in London called The Art of the Impossible, bringing together people from the worlds of theatre and politics and technology. And one of the theatre makers introduced us to this app. I think it's called Is a Dude Talking? You can use it in a meeting, and basically, like, somebody in the meeting agrees that they will be responsible for, like, running this and tracking the whole time, like sliding it backwards and forwards, yes or no. And so you get an objective statistical answer that you can actually be screening in real time behind the speakers on the stage or whatever, just to track whether one group of people is dominating the space. And Anna and I talk about this a lot when we're running this school together and hosting online sessions. And we're a double act, and I'm often the loud and loquacious side of that. And you know, then we're bringing groups together. And one thing that Anna says she's observed is this pattern where in the early phases of a group coming together, the men are more likely to take up space and do a lot of the talking, put themselves forward in the discussion sessions in the whole group and so on. But then as the group continues to meet over time and relationships are forged, something shifts and it seems to swing the other way with the women coming to the fore. Mm. And that's an interesting observation, one that I find hopeful for the ways that we're trying to work, which are very much about being embedded in relationship. And there's a bit of me that finds it very easy to say that I don't think measuring and counting is a substitute for building relationship. It's a bit like, you know, in a marriage, if you get to the point where you're arguing over who washes the dishes, you do not win that argument by going, as a matter of fact, I think you'll find that I washed the dishes 4 times last week. Because once you're keeping account of things, that in itself is a sign that the relationship is in a bad place. And if it's going to last much longer, you need to start from somewhere else than arguing over numbers. So yeah, it's like, it's easy for me to go, I don't think measuring and counting is the way we get to the kind of culture we want to have. And then I'm editing an episode of this podcast, and it was episode 2 of this series. And as I listen back, it hits me that I've managed to talk about a whole long list of essays and books, and every single one of them is by a bloke. So when it comes to keeping account of things, maybe it's back to Vanessa's point about the layers and how what might be unhelpful on one layer, when we do manage to create those contexts of relationship, can be helpful and appropriate on another in terms of keeping ourselves accountable. But obviously, if you put this podcast through the Is a Dude Talking app, the answer is 100% yes. And I guess my response to that is to try to be accountable for how I show up and whether I'm just reproducing things that I take for granted because of the various layers of privilege that make me who I am. And I am going to do that some of the time. Or whether I'm managing to embody a different way of showing up, maybe putting that privilege into service. I'd like to think that smalling yourself up can actually be a relief, setting down the burden and the bullshit of how you've been taught you're meant to be, learning to laugh at your own ridiculousness now and then.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? So if you dig into what lies behind smalling yourself up, you know, there's a sense that looking or feeling small is usually associated with humiliation or insignificance or even stupidity. You know, there's lots of negative connotations around the undesirable diminutive. You know, to call someone small implies they're narrow-minded or disappointing in some way. And I think, you know, if we fixate on our small screens to earn our small change, you know, we forget to read the small print, we end up working into the small hours, perhaps literally sweating the small stuff. But yeah, we make meaningless small talk. And we dismiss those in our power games we consider small fry. And it's small wonder that small as a word might be perceived to be problematic. And yet, if you get into the proverbial roots of small, it often works the other way. You know, the best things come in small packages. Being thankful for small blessings or mercies, listening to the small voice inside. And of course, my favourite is Small is Beautiful. And I mentioned that because it's such a humdinger, as it was the title of a key text in that nascent sustainability world from where I sprang, by the polymath E.F. Schumacher's book of the same name. And that was actually published the year after I was born, like 1973. And I don't know if we can say far-sighted in hindsight, but it was. And in many ways, it wove threads we're still pulling on today in this podcast. Like the Club of Rome report, Limits to Growth, which was published a year before, Schumacher excoriates that inherent unsustainability of the global economy due to its treatment of natural resources as income, not capital. And of course, this was half a century ago. And he warns, even then, of the inability of natural systems' resilience to cope with what we were throwing at them, and then raises concerns about incremental change or trust in technology transfer and innovation, because those would never address the root flaws in the economy. And I think it's important to note that for Schumacher, small didn't literally mean small either. It meant appropriate. You know, he was a massive advocate of what he called enoughness, which brought together real human needs, appropriate technology, technology of the right size and of the right method, and perhaps technology which answers the question rather than just asks the question. And his own experiences of village culture in India, what he called Buddhist economics. And I think that touches on many of the themes of our discussion. And there's a little quote I'd like to bring in from Schumacher, where he advises us to not simply outcapitalize the capitalists, an attempt in which they may or may not succeed, but to evolve a more democratic and dignified system of industrial administration, a more humane employment of machinery, and a more intelligent utilization of the fruits of human ingenuity and effort. And if you can do this, then you can have the future in your hands. If you can't, then you have nothing to offer that is worthy of the sweat of free-born men. And that's obviously a dude talking about men. But I think we see those themes playing out, whether it's in permaculture agricultural practice, which obviously generates higher food yields and biodiversity and ecology per hectare cultivated, but with fewer inputs, except that of human labour, so therefore bringing meaningful, if manual, work. Or even perhaps, you know, in the context of urban planning, the resurgence of the 15-minute city, where everything must be accessible by foot or bicycle in the time it might take you normally to wait for a bus or a train to go somewhere else. And I think there's much there in the sort of Illich conviviality, which I know is one of your favourite areas, Dougald.
Well, yeah, scale mattered a lot to Illich, certainly. He would have made the distinction between size, so talking about big or small, and proportionality. And you're right to say that for Schumacher, small didn't literally mean small. But the words we use have a life of their own. So the slogan says what it says to people rather than what he might have wanted it to say. So I can be a bit critical of Small is Beautiful, at least in the ways it tends to circulate. I feel like we need to think a little harder about this than that kind of formulation invites us to do. I think we can get into a sort of unhelpful polarization over scales. So you've got small is beautiful on the one side, and you've got fast is best, which could be the slogan of the accelerationists, on the other. And clearly the next thing to say is that there is a massive power imbalance between the two. We live in a world where the dominant forces are invested in speed and scale and bigness. I'm thinking now about something that the Belgian philosopher Isabel Stengers says, where she's making the case for slowing down. She says, "When I'm speaking of slowing down, I'm equating speed with mobilization. A mobilized army is an army that crosses the land with only one question. can we pass, indifferent to the damage it causes? Whatever may inspire hesitations or attention must be banished within this framework of mobilization. What slows the army down is seen only as an obstacle. And Stengish goes on to relate this to the way that the urgency of climate change and other crises seems to legitimize exactly this kind of impatient mobilization. I see as a major challenge, she says, this sense of urgency that the fast transformation of the earth may produce. We must stop quibbling. No time for that. We must act. This approach seems parallel to the demand to act in order to be competitive, to control market shares, or to rank our institutions. Since the 19th century, the sciences have been mobilized, have become fast sciences, with researchers regarding whatever concerns do not contribute directly to the advancement of knowledge as a sinful waste of time. Now, within the knowledge economy, fast sciences are perceived as not fast enough. They're making patents and launching fabulous promises of technological revolutions that are attractive for investors but don't need reliable knowledge. And the apotheosis of this paradigm is geoengineering, the mobilization of technology against the Earth. So, right, in this sense that saying that Stengers is speaking of, I'm all for a movement away from speed and bigness, towards the smaller and the slower, because that seems to me to be clearly the direction that is called for. But what I'd wish for is that rather than simply valorizing small or slow, we cultivate a literacy of scales. We pay attention to what becomes possible and what ceases to be possible as we move between operating at different scales or speeds. And I guess this is the subtlety that I find in Illich's thinking.
Yeah, it's interesting when you talk about moving between different scales or speeds, because obviously as a global slow traveler who circumnavigated the world without flying, I think I bestride that slow speed at great scale.
Right. So here's an example I always come back to. And I know I talked about this in series one. This 1905 San Francisco streetcar footage where someone put an early film camera, cinema camera on the front of a streetcar and filmed the journey through the streets of San Francisco the year before the earthquake. And it's best known now because it was used as a music video by Air for their song La Femme d'Argent. But you get this extraordinary interweaving of cars and horses and buses and carts and pedestrians and children playing, running across the tracks in front of the tram. And when Air used this, people thought it was choreographed. They thought it was faked because it's hard to believe that this degree of complexity of interweaving is spontaneous. Because once you have vehicles present in the streetscape that are going above a certain speed, it's not possible anymore. That speed in itself, and not everybody's speed, but just there being actors within the situation operating at that speed, forces a brutal simplification on everybody else. And the space has to be transformed around the car. The street can no longer be a convivial space of being human together. It's reduced to purely a communications channel for transporting people and stuff from A to B. And I literally watched this happening in Xinjiang in the far west of China in 2004. And I spent 6 months there, and the speed of transformation going on in the city where we were was breathtaking. And the back streets, when I was first walking around them, were still full of old men sitting out playing Chinese chess on tables in the middle of the street. And 6 months later, you'd come down the same street and it was barely recognizable because buildings had been pulled down and buildings four times the height had replaced them. And in the process, the street was now a space dominated by the cars that were increasingly arriving as private vehicles in that city. And Illich talks about the speed-stunned imagination. Once we're normalized to speed and the simplification required for it, the possibilities that have been eliminated as a side effect of that become simply unimaginable. We just can't believe that there are other ways of taking up space, other ways of being human together. And if you extend this from the specific case of the street and the cityscape, you can see that the same pattern around speed and scale goes on all over the place. In fact, it's a lot like the disembedding that I've been talking about from Karl Polanyi over the past couple of episodes. The brutal simplification of the motorized street space is akin to the brutal simplification of the market society, in which the fabric of human activity is torn up and shredded and required to reform in a way that will fit inside this thing that's now known as the economy. And Illich would say it's not about slow being better or small being beautiful, exactly. It's that we need to attend to the hidden costs when we pass a certain threshold of speed or of scale or of intensity, that there are qualitative side effects, and that part of those side effects is this stunning of the imagination, that we don't even have words to describe what has been lost. Or worse, that our attempts to do so may conjure up something poisonous, some travesty of the thing towards which we were trying to gesture.
You're making me think about the holiday industry now, and how our relentless pace of working life makes us desperate for an escape. That actually may end up being a crude pastiche of really pleasurable leisure, and then that drip, drip, drip anticipation of these meagre morsels blinds us to the reality of how we spend the rest of our lives. It's intriguing, though, in that Illichian context, I do wonder whether the pandemic and some of the reclamation of road space for outdoor and alfresco hospitality and physically distanced mobility might actually help us tune back in to our speed-stunned imaginations a little and perhaps reconnect with Illich's sense of what a human-scale streetscape conviviality might look and feel like. And imagine once the new pavement bars and cafes are firmly established, will they voluntarily relinquish their newly acquired expansiveness? And will we want to see those promenades bustling with people returned, as you say, to the brutal simplification of the car? Certainly I hope and suspect it may not be the case, because the reality has been rewritten on the ground. But you're also making me think about scale. Often when I joke about being a recovering sustainability consultant, I think at least part of that is about interrogating my own hubris, stepping back a little from that grand stage I was so keen to stride before onto something rather smaller, perhaps a little jetty over the river at the mill. And maybe our moves to smaller places that we might call home are not retreats, but a rescaling of ambitions to an intimate, a more local context, maybe. The cheesy epitome of think global, act local. And I was just ruminating on this because the Parish Council Allotment Committee chairperson clocked my email signature with various sort of greeny references in it. And I've already been invited to join the steering group of the Neighbourhood Development Plan. And somehow, you know, that feels far more modest and meaningful and immediate. And it brought to mind my Forward Institute colleague, the awesome Margaret Heffernan, you know, who's run several huge global businesses, written many books, and is a force majeure for responsible leadership. And she's done something similar in her village, you know, bringing her phenomenal mind and heart to her own doorsteps deliberations. And, you know, it's not a good life back to the land type of idealism, but it does feel interesting.
So I want to just back up here a minute, because there's a case that could be made against some of what we're talking about here. And it goes like this. It's all right for you lot, retreating into your Ambridge-scale world of parish councils while society crumbles. And if I wanted to really ground this in what that crumbling looks like, I'd go back to Alan Lane from Slung Low Theatre Company in Leeds, who I quoted in Series 1, and a post of his from the autumn, where he's updating on their experience of feeding the hungry in the community around them. And he's talking about what he wants to say to others in the arts when they ask him whether he really thinks it's the job of arts organisations to be running food banks. And here's what he says. He says, "I don't think every theatre should open a food bank, no. But this sector, which prides itself on its imagination, should do something, can do something. For months, food banks were desperate for vans, and there were so many vans on the forecourts of arts organisations doing nothing. And that's a failure of imagination. There were theatres with empty fridges and freezers, and so many charitable organisations desperate for spaces in both, and that's a failure of imagination. And the Cultural Recovery Fund is here, and the money is here to shore up organisations and to support the making of many people redundant, which made me realise that maybe the money wasn't rescuing who I thought it was. And there's a choice to look for long-term safety or immediate vitalness. And look at your communities. Look at the levels of unemployment. Look at child hunger. Look at the panic and weariness of your fellow citizens in the communities your audiences come from, and crucially, those they don't. And no, you don't have to open a food bank, but you do have to do something, or they will remember what we all did as a sector and all we did not do. We have the power to reimagine our relationship, what we're for, and what we can achieve, or we cannot do that. But they'll remember. They'll all remember. So, you know, as someone who's also moved to a smaller, more rural place in the past few months, I don't want to be too comfortable with the possibility that part of what we're doing, part of what we're able to do, is retreating from what's going on in our societies. I'm not saying that's what you or I are doing exactly, but I need to keep that in view as part of the mix, part of what this might be, if I'm going to make decisions and act in a way that makes this something other than that. And then again, thinking about scale, I remember this line from the political theorist Jody Dean, where she says, "Goldman Sachs doesn't care if you raise chickens." And this is picked up by some of the accelerationist writers in the last few years as a kind of rallying point against what they call folk politics. And Chris Smage talks about this in his book, A Small Farm Future, which I would love to talk about for a whole episode because there's so much to get into there. It's an extraordinary book. But at the end of that, he has an epilogue which is titled, "Does Goldman Sachs Care If You Raise Chickens?" And here's the conclusion that he gets to. It's true, of course, that we're facing some vast and pressing global problems, but one of the main reasons they're so vast and pressing is that we've been unable to think outside the frameworks that continue to generate them. So we keep amplifying them. Humanity is now sailing in dangerous waters. I've tried to chart what now seems to me our safest course. And this is the argument he's been making in the book, that a revival of small-scale agriculture is our best shot at navigating the multiple crises around and ahead of us. Though, as he goes on, without illusions about the difficulties of following it and the chances of success. I think it involves rejecting grand solutionism and creating local autonomies as best we can that may just see us through into a new phase of history with its own contradictions and difficulties. We need to prefigure it by thinking and farming for the long haul. It begins when you start raising chickens. And I suppose what I'd want to add to those lines from Chris is that when you look at what Slung Low are doing in Leeds, or other artists who embody in different ways what it means to face and do something about the crises around us right here and now. I'm thinking of the artist Shanna van Heeswijk, for example. They are working at ground level, at the human scale, in the communities where they find themselves too. And for me, part of what I see us doing with this school called Home is to offer a space of refuge and reflection and sustenance to people, some of whom are absolutely there working on the front line in communities that are being hit hardest, or people who are trying to find a map that might help them work out where the front line is, what work is worth doing, or summon up the courage to step into doing something like that with their lives.
Yeah, it's interesting you talk about the failure of the imagination of the arts through Alan Lane's Slung Low community work. I'm just doing a tiny small yourself up piece of work for Geely's bicycle and wrangling with some of their communications. And their premises change culture and culture changes the world. And it's very much around that enabling role. But I wonder to what extent they've actually engaged with, you know, the genuinely radical grassroots activity and the cumulative effect that could have. And I'm now wondering if they have a van the local food bank can borrow.
Yeah, it might be a cargo bike rather than a van, yeah, given their name. I was thinking about how to end things up this week, where to land this episode. And then I got an invitation from the composer Lola Perrin, who's the founder of Climate Keys and an XR activist and many other things, who's organising this live-streamed reading marathon to coincide with the hearing that will have taken place by the time this episode goes out. It's happening on May the 10th, where the UK government is seeking to jail the barrister Tim Crosland, who deliberately broke the embargo on the announcement of Heathrow Airport Limited's successful appeal to give the go-ahead for a third runway. And he broke it as an act of civil disobedience and, you know, as a very serious decision as somebody who's spent his working life in the law, to break the law to highlight how the expansion of Heathrow violates the goals of the Paris Agreement. And so while Tim is in court, a bunch of us will be doing this non-stop reading. And the invitation that came said, we want people to read historic speeches, ancient codes, landmark manifestos, and protest poems that highlight the role law can play in guaranteeing human rights and preventing injustices. I had to think for a while about what I wanted to read. And in the end, I chose two things. One is a short passage from Tyson Yunker Porter's book, Sand Talk, that we often refer to in these conversations, where he's writing about Aboriginal understandings of law and things that are going on today. And he says, there are people today fighting to transform our law into a hybrid entity that may be recognised in Australian and international law. And then there are the old fellas who keep the original law for us, holding it against the day of resurgence that will come. And what struck me rereading that is, it's not either or. It's not choosing between the big of international and the quiet, seemingly too small to matter work of those old fellas, as he says, who don't want to be written about or filmed. There's room in what he's saying for both these things. And then the second thing I chose to read is one of my favourite poems that's ever been in Dark Mountain. It's by Kate Chapman, who's one of the Dark Mountain editors these days. It's called Protest Poem. And I wanted to read that here. I can't write a protest poem. I'm not recounting all the various horrors I know about and know nothing about. I'm not qualified, and you're not really interested. We're long inured through our flat, familiar reel of slippery imagery. Distance and repetition renders everything meaningless, like a word said over and over. But I will tell you about the fierce, bright love I feel for my father, and about the yellow shock of a rape field I saw through a train window, sudden between the green hills, and the yellow rush of a woodpecker's tail feathers, and the yellow host of dandelions shining, vivid and defiant, in my friend's unkempt garden as I kissed her on leaving last week. Because these are things I can hold with some degree of understanding, and they help me remember that my eyes are greedy for all sorts of colours and forms, and my heart, fist-sized and fist-shaped, will beat for a while longer and then stop beating. When we think and talk big, it's easy for that bigness to be a refuge from the fragility of being embodied creatures with fist-sized, fist-shaped hearts that beat for a while and then stop. There's a passage in John Berger's book, Bento's Sketchbook, where he talks about the disturbance of distances. A disturbance that can only be accommodated if one takes an aerial view in which kilometres become millimetres yet in which the size of our human hearts is not reduced. Maybe that's what I'm reaching for, a literacy of scales that is more paradoxical than just saying small is beautiful, that is insistently paradoxical, that doesn't shy away from the need to confront and engage the biggest scales, but which doesn't take all those big systems and institutions and scales as seriously as they demand to be taken, that says the global is a fantasy. The nation state is a fantasy. Powerful fantasies, dangerous fantasies, fantasies with consequences. But these things are not real in the way that a human heart is real, or in the way that we are real to each other when we gather around a table and share food and breathe the same air. As we scale up and away from the smallness and fragility and surprising resilience of these creatures we actually are, we're always in danger of losing ourselves in delusion. So when we do engage on the big scale, and sometimes we need to do that, then I think we also need these lifelines, these heart lines to hold us, to anchor us, to keep us real. Thank you for listening to The Great Humbling. If you're new to the podcast, we'd invite you to check out the journey we've been on over the earlier episodes. In Series 1, we explored the sense-making stories taking shape through the first months of the pandemic. And Series 2 tracked the altered states of consciousness, being and feeling that we were seeing around us. This is an open-ended process, and we're keen to hear from you. So please do comment, ask questions, and respond via our Facebook page, The Great Humbling, or on Twitter, where Ed is at @FruCool. We're grateful to all of you who've been giving ratings, reviews, and recommendations, and sharing this podcast along your networks. And if you want to get deeper into the territory we explore in these conversations, do check out aschoolcalledhome.org. where you can sign up for live online courses and events. These are extraordinary times, a moment of initiation at a cultural scale. So thank you for being with us on this emergent journey.